ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A body on the train tracks in mysterious circumstances.
Mark's been found on railway tracks.
An award-winning ABC podcast and a fresh inquest underway.
Every time we walk out of that inquest, just being like, oh my God.
You weren't out there on the train tracks that night?
Absolutely not.
As the answers get closer, the podcast is back.
He said he's guilty. He's guilty as sin.
Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. How many zeros are there in a billion? A trillion. If you don't know straight away, Elon Musk will soon be able to tell you because he is on track to become the world's first trillionaire. I'll unpick how one man can amass such wealth and where that leaves the rest of us in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, are you sick of talking about traffic and the weather? Have you ever wished we could just ditch small talk entirely? What happens when you dispense with the pleasantries is coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, last week, police and health inspectors shut down two illicit tobacco stores in Sydney, the first to be closed under new state laws targeting illegal tobacco, which is big business. Organised crime is making about $10 billion a year from it, and it comprises half of the products sold to the country's 2.7 million smokers. And we've seen violent turf wars from the related underworld conflict. Meanwhile, the legal sale of cigarettes has slowed. Woolworths and Coles are both reporting sales of cigarettes are way down, and the head of the Ritchie's supermarket group, which is aligned with IGA, says he'll consider removing cigarettes from supermarkets altogether. So what impact is this having on Australia's smoking rates and your local community? If the goal is fewer smokers and a healthier population, are we still on the right track? With me is Anita Desai, the chair of Cancer Council Australia's Public Health Committee, Dr. Raglan Maddox, associate professor of the tobacco-free team at Australian National University, and Theo Fakari, who's the CEO of the Australian Association of Convenience Stores. Anita, I might start with you. Last week, we saw these store closures. They're the first under the new New South Wales state government laws. How has the availability of cheap illegal tobacco products affected smoking trends, as far as we can tell?
Look, first and foremost, we're very supportive and certainly welcome the moves by New South Wales Health and the New South Wales government regarding really tackling what we know is happening in community, which is tobacco retailers knowingly doing the wrong thing and selling illicit tobacco. Really importantly, it's important to remember that overall, right across New South Wales and in Australia, we are seeing continued declines in smoking. So we have smoking rates sitting at about 10%. The issue we have with illicit is that it threatens to undermine this progress, and that's what we're most concerned about.
What do we know about the people who are more likely to buy illicit tobacco?
We know that illicit tobacco is obviously becoming an increasing problem. I really need to emphasise, though, that when it comes to tobacco use, the overwhelming majority of people who do smoke want to quit. So 2/3 of smokers want to quit tobacco, whether it's legal or illegal. And so the focus really needs to be here on supporting those smokers who we know want to quit. And that includes really curbing the availability of illicit tobacco through retail environments.
So Dr. Raglan Maddox, also here in the chat, part of the tobacco-free team at the ANU, you found that while rates of smoking are declining, they're not dropping as much among young people as older people. What do you think is behind this?
Yeah, I think it's an ongoing challenge, and sort of as Anita alluded to, the vast majority of people who smoke want to quit or wish they never took it up. So I think that's really important and speaks to that addictive nature of things. Probably since COVID, I think we've seen a really concerted effort from the tobacco industry and retailers to target people. We've seen that with the illicit trade of vaping products. We've seen vaping stores pop up at schools, around schools, really targeting children, young people. And we're starting to see that with illicit tobacco stores popping up everywhere with this approach to really normalise and re-socialise tobacco, even though we know the majority of people are trying to quit. So as a community, as a society, we need to ask ourselves, how can we better support people who are smoking to try and quit, given that two-thirds of those people who smoke will die from tobacco-related disease. I think that's incredibly important on the back of, 75 years we've known that this product kills when used as directed, and we continue to have over 40,000 stores around the country.
Here on ABC Radio National, you're listening to Life Matters. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking with Anita Desai from Cancer Council Australia's Public Health Committee, and Dr. Raglan Maddox, who's with the tobacco-free team at the ANU, about the fact that retail sales of tobacco seem to be declining, but the illicit tobacco market is here and is still quite large. One text says the government policy of taxing tobacco has left a very vulnerable section of the population open to severe health risks. Cheap tobacco is a completely unregulated material, very much more toxic than legal cigarettes. All the work done to identify tar and nicotine content went out the window with plain packaging, and the extraordinary taxes have driven addicts to buy contraband that's produced by criminals. The health effects won't be able to be registered for many years, but we'll see a dramatic rise in health problems in years to come. Anita, what's your read on that?
Look, as I've said, we're incredibly concerned about, the increasing availability of illicit tobacco. But really importantly, whether it's illegal tobacco or whether it's legal tobacco, smoking kills 66 Australians every day. And again, to emphasise, the focus needs to be on what we know. These consumers, yes, they are addicted, but they really want to quit smoking. And so the focus needs to be on, well, what can we do to help support these smokers to quit? We don't want to see, we're talking here about mums and dads, uncles, sisters, brothers. We don't want to see further deaths as a result of tobacco use. The emphasis needs to be on supporting smokers to quit. And the government has at its hand a range of different measures that it can employ to help support and continue to drive down smoking rates. And that includes public education campaigns, which really do encourage and remind not just people who do smoke about the health harms of tobacco use, but really, really importantly, it prevents that potential next generation of customers for big tobacco from taking up smoking. Prevention is really key here, and what we don't want to see is the issue of illicit tobacco undermining Australia's progress in driving down smoking rates. And we want to avoid the next generation getting hooked on this very addictive product, whether it's legal or illegal.
What other prevention methods should we be doubling down on?
We know that there's a range of policy measures that have proven incredibly effective in Australia in helping to drive down smoking rates. Public education campaigns are critical. So we know that overwhelmingly one of the primary reasons that people want to give up smoking is the health harms. So making sure that all Australian governments are investing in these public education campaigns that raise awareness of the health harms and making sure that they are well funded. So it can't be sporadic. This needs to be consistent public education. Price has been an important measure. And so any suggestion by industry or retailer front groups that we should be, halving or reducing it back to the price of the early 2000s is ridiculous. But we also know that other policy measures like smoke-free environments have also played a really important role in driving down smoking rates. So the focus isn't just on price, it's a focus on making sure that we're doing everything that we can to help drive down smoking rates, encourage smokers to quit, and provide those proven effective methods to support smokers to quit.
Also with me is Theo Fakari, who's the CEO of the Australian Association of Convenience Stores. Theo, in a sense, you're very much customer facing here. What impact has the illicit tobacco trade had on the people in your association?
So I think, first and foremost, we don't think anyone should smoke or vape. But the unfortunate reality is, as has been documented earlier in this conversation, is that it's an addictive product. And the challenge that we have in Australia is, so the members that we represent in the last 3 months, they have experienced a 55% decline in their legal sales. And that's on top of 30% last year and 20% the prior year. So our retailers over the last 4 years have actually lost $2 billion in legal sales. And, you know, if people were quitting smoking, there's not really an issue that we would have with it. The biggest challenge that we have is that the availability of illegal tobacco now, more broadly, is firstly, it's more available than ever. Secondly, I think, you know, the price that it's available, it can be as cheap as $7.50 if you buy it in a carton and you buy it online delivered to your door, which, by the way, is illegal. But on average, it's about $15. And versus a legal product equivalent of a 20s pack, the price is anywhere from $45 to $50. So our retailers that we represent, ultimately we're losing foot traffic to our stores, and we're losing that traffic to organised crime groups who are using the funding to be able to, or the profits to be able to drive other illegal activities. Now, we've had a large number of members that have reported their overall gross profit to their store with the reduction of legal tobacco has actually cut their gross profit down in half. And that's already resulted in loss of jobs. Additionally, with more than 250 firebombings by the crime groups on or against one another, we now have a community issue where we have staff on the front line, of which our industry employs about 80,000 people that are serving customers 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In a lot of cases, they're actually scared to go to work. And we're not only being targeted by these criminal groups we're actually being targeted for legal products. So the latest trend, which has been in place for the last 12 months, is a lot of our retailers are actually getting held up in broad daylight. They're having their legal product stolen to be then onsold to the illegal market at a cheap price. So not only is it affecting the ongoing viability of the businesses, it's also affecting the general safety of our staff, and it's also affecting the additional or add-on sales like a sandwich or a coffee or some top-up groceries when consumers come to our stores. So, you know, again, I think this issue of illicit tobacco has always been around for some time, but the truth of the matter is 2/3 of the adult population that smoke today are actually purchasing illegal product. So all of the great work around public health messaging, education, plain packaging, on-pack messaging, messages on the stick, public health campaigns, these people that are using illicit tobacco aren't even seeing this messaging or all of the hard work that's gone into this space. So
can I just fact check?
I think it's a...
Yeah, sorry. Theo, no one should feel unsafe going to work. I thank you for your... For that insight, because I think it's really important for people to understand what the retailers are up against. I just wanted to pick up on that thing. 2/3 of smokers are using illicit products. Anita, do we know what the numbers are around who's using it?
No, I think I'd certainly have to challenge Theo and the sources of that. I'd also need to point out that I understand Theo needs to represent the interests of obviously retailers, but I also appreciate he's representing the interests of his suppliers and other long-standing members who profit from tobacco sales, which includes big tobacco. So I understand that he's representing the needs, as I said, of his members, but that does include big tobacco companies. And at the end of the day, we're talking about public health policy for which tobacco industry and its retailers don't have a role to play in forming public health policy.
Theo, can you talk to the group makeup? Your group does represent retailers, but it also includes tobacco companies. What kind of influence are they exerting over your messaging?
First and foremost, our messaging is based on the feedback we receive from retailers. So our strategic priorities as an industry is effectively developed by retailers, and then we advocate on their behalf. So, you know, to clarify, yes, we have the three large multinationals that are members of our organisation. They pay a membership fee. Those fees are available on our website. But it's 3 out of 120 manufacturers or suppliers to the petrol and convenience industry that are tobacco. So we have people that supply beverages and food and services and IT solutions and sandwiches and grocery products and distributors. So, you know, there's been this perception that we're funded by the tobacco industry. We absolutely are not funded by the tobacco industry, but I have never hidden behind the fact that 3 of our 120 supplier members are tobacco companies. So, and again, all of the messaging that we put out is driven by retailers and the strategic priorities that our industry has. When we have legal sales transferring to the illegal market, that is an issue. When it's going to cost jobs, when it's going to cause harm, not only for our frontline staff, but the general community that we support every day, it's a problem. And we need to continue to be the voice for that.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor with Theo Fakara, who's the CEO of the Australian Association of Convenience Stores, Anita Desai from the Cancer Council, and Raglan Maddox from the tobacco-free team at ANU, talking about the role that illicit tobacco is playing in trying to cut down on smoking rates in Australia. One says, in my Sydney suburb, there are half a dozen shops selling lollies out front and tobacco and vape products. Why aren't they being targeted? Surely there is a licensing process for shops that could pick them up. So predatory. And Lisa says, I have two sisters living in different suburbs to me. They both buy under-the-counter cigarettes. I went shopping with her and she told me I have to stay out of sight while she asked for them so as not to spook the shopkeeper. I mentioned the cigarettes could have anything in them, but they did not care. I say, Lisa says, put more money and resources into keeping illegal cigarettes out of Australia. Well, Raglan, all of these texts, there's more, are saying taxation and cost is enabling the black market. Would it make sense to lower the cost of legal products if that is going to maybe help stamp out organised crime?
Look, I don't think so. Realistically, we've got a discrepancy with the amount of profit that people can make from tobacco products. We've got a balance at the moment. What we're seeing is the messaging going out that you can buy this illicit product pretty much anywhere under the counter, as we've heard, which is undermining people's ability to quit and continues to normalise it, make it accessible. What we need to see is strong enforcement. We've seen a number of jurisdictions now tightening their tobacco licensing, retail licensing, wholesale licensing, and we're starting to see jurisdictions really ramp up the enforcement. So I expect to see over the coming months and years that this enforcement will ultimately drive down the illicit market and again support everyday Australians who are trying to quit. I just wanted to draw on what Anita was saying. We have this inherent conflict of interest where we listen to people that are profiting at the expense of the health and well-being of everyday Australians. And as a result, we tend to silence Australians that are, you know, really grappling with an addiction and with the cost of living, all those things, addiction is incredibly hard. So how do we also support youth, young people, current and future generations to live a life free from addiction? I think that's an incredibly important part of this conversation.
You mentioned different jurisdictions before. In some places, they're not allowed to use the name, the word tobacco or tobacconist in their stores. Is that something that you might see here?
Yeah, look, I think so. I think we can learn a lot from other countries, other jurisdictions, where they also come up against tobacco industry retailers trying to profit at the expense of their citizens. What we've seen in places like New Zealand is legislation to remove the socialisation, the marketing of things like the word tobacconist, tobacco, things like that, because we know what we have done well in Australia is public health, as we've heard across this conversation. We don't see as explicit targeting and promotion that we used to see. You know, we had the Winfield Cup, Benson and Hedges, all sorts of tobacco marketing. And so we see industries really being innovative as possible, making sure that the word tobacco, smoke, all those sorts of things are still in everyday vernacular, that we see it on the street, we see it on the street corner. And what I'm hearing from youth and young people is, like, at what point do we learn from this? You know, we've seen loved ones pass away. I suspect every Australian's been touched by the tobacco industry in some shape or form. We've lost a loved one. When do we start to learn from the those challenges that generations before us have learnt to make sure we support people to be free from addiction and not take it up, because, you know, not taking it up is a lot easier than trying to kick the habit and get rid of this addiction, especially when it's so pervasive, when that industry is predatory and it is everywhere.
You work at the tobacco-free team, Raglan. Is the ultimate goal here that Australia is tobacco-free altogether? Is that realistic?
I think it absolutely is realistic. We're dealing with a man-made disease. We've seen over the last 5-10 years what happens when countries mobilise and address things like COVID. I'm not saying I ever want to see a COVID or experience a COVID lockdown again. That's not what I'm talking about. But in comparison, we are seeing 24,000 Australians die every year, 66 Australians every day, and I don't take that lightly. And so I think what we're hearing from youth and young people is, when does this change? At what point do we stop burying our loved ones and start implementing structural measures to support particularly our children from taking up these products? As Anita said before, the majority of people who smoke want to quit. So how do we make sure that people are informed about these decisions, that there isn't this accessibility where you can get tobacco product 24/7, but you can't pick up your groceries, where you can't pick up prescriptions, where the cost of actual living life free from addiction is harder than it is to buy a pack of smokes?
Theo, are your retailers prepared for a likelihood that all tobacco products could be illegal at some point?
Some retailers are absolutely prepared and others are in the process of being prepared. But, you know, I think on the current decline rates that we're experiencing, we believe within 2 to 3 years maximum, the entire tobacco sales or products that are consumed by adults will actually be supplied by organised crime groups. And our retailers are doing a lot of things, predominantly focused around selling more food, more beverages, more groceries, changing their in-store offer to be able to still obviously remain commercially viable. I just want to pick up on a couple of the comments that both of the group have spoken about, because I think what's been missed in all of this is, you know, we continue to hear smoking rates are going down. It's an absolute lie, okay? WA, as recently as 2 or 3 weeks ago, have reported that their smoking rate has gone from 10 to 12% in the last 2 years. Roy Morgan have also indicated that smoking rates are increasing. Smoking rates are increasing. They actually put the number, and again, their data is independent. It's free from government funding. They believe that the adult smoking rate is at 12.1%. And then when we throw nicotine vaping into it, of which is completely supplied by the illegal market, because the pharmaceutical model that has been implemented and now in place for 4 years, that has had 3 or 4 goes at trying to make it work, has actually not worked. So right now, about 80% of all nicotine products that are consumed in Australia are supplied by crime groups. Additionally, the ACIC, which is the Australian Crime and Corruption Intelligence Commission, they run a wastewater analysis looking at all sorts of relevant drugs in the water system. Nicotine is at its highest level since they started recording this 8 years ago. So the reality of the matters are, we have more nicotine being consumed by Australians. Smoking rates are increasing. We've got, I don't call them retailers because they're not. They're breaking the law and they're criminals. They are selling to anybody, including children, and they're doing that because we have policy in place that has effectively allowed these crime groups to profit. Now, we only need to look at countries like Sweden as an example. So Sweden will be the first country in the world that will, by definition of the World Health Organization, be smoke-free. And that status is when you achieve 5% or lower of tobacco consumption. Now, what they've done, they don't have a significant excise. They have adopted tobacco harm reduction products like vaping and pouches, of which are banned in Australia. And they have provided consumers with the ability to make an informed choice. They continue with their education, which is very important. But in Australia, and I don't know the number exactly, but it would have to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars, if not low billions, that has been spent on public education, public health education on the risks associated with smoking. And the policies that we have in place, like it or not, are failing.
Theo, I'm going to have to pull you up because on time. I'm really sorry to jump in again, but just back to Anita, just on some of those stats that Theo pulled out there, how does that sit with what you've seen in your research?
Oh, look, there's so much misinformation in what Theo's just covered off. I think the key things to point out is that smoking rates do continue to decline. And so if we wind the clock back to the early 2000s when we had about one in four Australians who were smoking back then, we're now at a point where we have around 10% smoking right across Australia. In relation to what we're seeing in Western Australia, we've seen blips along the way over the past 20 years when it comes to smoking prevalence. And that includes in New South Wales, where year on year we might see smoking rates tick up a little bit. But what we're interested in is that overall trend. And so that trend data is important. We are all monitoring smoking prevalence very, very closely. And we have certainly been concerned from a public health perspective of the role that e-cigarettes have potentially played in undermining tobacco control policies, particularly in relation to quite significant uptake of vaping amongst young people. So overwhelmingly, the trend as it relates to smoking prevalence continues to decline. Theo has known this since the early 2000s, and I think Raglan's already alluded to the fact smoking rates, because by nature of the fact that they are declining, this isn't a sustainable market. And so we will get to a point in Australia, and Australia does have a target of reaching 5% smoking by 2030, where this isn't a viable market. So Australia will get to a point where we will not have a viable market for tobacco smoking, and the focus needs to be on everything that we can do to help continue to prevent the uptake of smoking and support smokers to quit so we can reach that target.
Just briefly, Anita, how can we know how reliable that data is if there is so much illicit tobacco in the mix?
Look, we obviously, the most important thing is that we are drawing on data sources where we have been continuing to monitor smoking prevalence for quite some time. So drawing on data like the Australian Institute for Health and Welfare, the National Drug Strategy Household Survey, where we are measuring continuous trends, that is reliable data. And I think we should certainly be challenging and questioning any industry-linked or industry-funded data that is being put out into the media.
Just briefly, what is the way forward from a public health perspective, Anita?
So in the immediate short term, what we're wanting to make sure is that, we're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater here. We have good policies in place in every jurisdiction and right across Australia. So it's making sure that we're strengthening tobacco retailer policies, making sure that we've got the very best functioning tobacco retail licensing schemes right across Australia, and seeing obviously moves in states like New South Wales, where we're introducing new landlord provisions, where landlords may be able to terminate a lease of premises subject to closure orders. So where they know that someone who is leasing a shop is knowingly selling illicit tobacco. So making sure that we're strengthening those types of policies. But equally, it's not just about the retail environment. So making sure that governments are funding public education campaigns, which are really reinforcing the health harms of tobacco. They play a really important role in motivating those two-thirds of smokers who we know want to quit to successfully quit.
Thank you all so much for sharing your insights today. Anita Desai, Chair of Cancer Council Australia's Public Health Committee, Dr. Raglan Maddox, Associate Professor at the Tobacco Free Team at Australian National University, and Theo Fakari, who's the CEO of the Australian Association of Convenience Stores. And thank you for your texts as well. A lot of you seeing this in the wild. One says we need a reporting line. Currently, the only way to report someone selling an illegal tobacco is very difficult. It needs to be super simple, send a photo with the address to this place and have something done about it. Another says, I work with young people in Auburn and they don't know the difference between legal and illegal tobacco. None of them should even be smoking, but it seems to be the absolute norm to be able to buy a tobacco or a vape at any shop in Auburn. Well, stick with me because coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, the world could soon have its first trillionaire. How do you feel about a planet where one person can accumulate so much wealth?
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration.
I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
It's quite incredible.
Dear Jane, on The Book Show, Mondays at 10 on ABC Radio National, or anytime on the ABC Listen app.
What could you buy with $1 trillion? It's hard to get your head around just how much money that is, let alone how one person could accumulate that kind of wealth. I will be honest, I had to remind myself just how many zeros that is. It's 12, by the way. Anyway, the world's richest man, Elon Musk, had a record-breaking pay package approved by Tesla shareholders, which could make him the first person in history to become a trillionaire. So how do we get to a place where one person can accumulate that much wealth? And why is the gap widening between the world's richest and the rest of us? I might be able to ask Karl Rhodes, Professor of Business and Society at the University of Technology, Sydney, and the author of Stinking Rich, The Four Myths of the Good Billionaire. Karl, welcome to Life Matters.
Hey, great to be on the show, Tegan.
So I don't even know how to wrap my head around the size of $1 trillion. I'm imagining Scrooge McDuck diving into like a vault. Can you break down for me how much we're talking?
Yeah, I mean, it is an unfathomable amount. I mean, it's more than the, you know, annual GDP of Switzerland. You know, if you got this money and had it in $100 notes, you'd have 10 tons of money. And if you think of it kind of, you know, more differently in terms of economic inequality, which is what this really represents, if you look at the distribution of wealth in the world, you know, $1 trillion is more than the entire wealth of the bottom quarter. So more wealth than 2 billion people in the entire world. You know, it's enough money to cover the Australian federal education budget for schools for 50 years. Now, you could buy every single housing unit in Brisbane and you still have change from $1 trillion. I mean, it's hard to think of it as anything but a grotesque amount of money for one person to have.
So if, he's not a trillionaire yet, but let's say Elon Musk decided to divide it equally among every person in the world, what are we talking here?
Well, there are about 8.2 billion people in the world, so that's that would come out at about $12 per person. If you think of Australia, we've got 26 million people, and you converted it to Australian dollars, it would be about 60,000 per person. Bearing in mind, the minimum wage is 48,000, so it's a considerable amount of money, even if you were to think of distributing it. I don't think that's going to happen, by the way. It's a very hypothetical question you're asking.
So your book is all about the myths of the good billionaire. You might have to rewrite it to update it to talking about trillionaires as well. Some people say it shouldn't be possible for one person to have that much money. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And it's, in a sense, it's not just about one person. It's about how the fact that this exists, and according to Oxfam, there's going to be 5 trillionaires in the next 10 years. So it's not even just him. It just represents a very much a kind of gross and worsening level of economic inequality around the world. I mean, even if you look at last year, in 2024, billionaire wealth grew by $2 trillion, and that was a 15% increase. It went up to a total of $15 trillion, so a 15% increase in 1 year. Meanwhile, according to the World Bank, 44% of the world's population live under the poverty line. And so it's bad. Even in wealthy countries like Australia, you know, poverty in 2001 was 12.4%, and that's now increased to 14.2%. 1 in 7 people living in poverty in Australia, which is a wealthy country. And it's particularly bad for young people, who it seems this generation are going to be financially worse off than their parents. I mean, young people are deciding not to have children because they can't afford it. That's the kind of the bigger issues that this extreme wealth of one person, you know, talks about a whole system of inequality that's growing across the world, including with us.
What is it about this moment in time and the way we've set up our economic system that it's possible for someone to have accumulated this much?
Well, it's really, you know, part of a long period of development that's happened. I mean, this hasn't happened suddenly. And in many ways, this is down to changes set in place globally around government policies. You know, sometimes people call it neoliberalism and the kind of things that were set in place by Margaret Thatcher in the UK and Ronald Reagan in the US. So billionaires have taken advantage of a political system. You know, billionaires often will have you think that they're self-made men. I say men deliberately, most of them are men. And the real fact is that they're just a manifestation of a global policy mistake that was made years ago around the way globalization was managed, around corporate deregulation, you know, tax reforms that favor capital over labor, you know, financialization where asset growth is much bigger than salaries, deunionization. You know, but lack of control over market concentration. You know, we were told that wealth would trickle down, but the opposite's happened. You know, it's trickled up.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Carl Rhodes, a professor of business and society at UTS, about the fact that Elon Musk is poised to be the world's first trillionaire. Peter says, imagine the good you could do for wildlife and ecology with that money, or housing for people. Neoliberal capitalism is immoral and cruel considering there's so much need. Sonia says, I'd pay off my mortgage and set up my two kids for life. Then the rest of the money to go to public housing so that every Aussie has a home. So, Carl, if we've set up an economic system that has allowed this to happen, could we change it to make our economic system more just and equitable?
Of course you could. And if you think about this, you know, there are some countries that are more equitable than others, countries like Japan and Finland and Norway and Sweden. And the characteristics of those countries is that they have strong welfare provisions, they have strong public services around education, around retirement incomes, around health. They have progressive tax systems. They have, healthy levels of wealth and inheritance tax. So there's a range of things that can happen. And those countries also are very, very wealthy countries. GDP per capita is high. Economic growth is high as well. And so productivity is high. So these are examples. So, you know, very deliberate policy changes around services, welfare, and taxation can really make all the difference.
How does Australia fit into this picture? We don't have any trillionaires. No one does yet, but we have a fair few billionaires. Are there other things we could be doing to make Australia more just?
Yeah, well, these are the things that could be done around tax reform, for example, in particular. You could reform capital gains tax. You could phase out negative gearing. You could implement direct wealth taxes. You could reduce reliance on income tax, make that more progressive, so it reduces reliance on spending for more people. Tax welfare transfers through inheritance and gift taxes. You know, you could modify superannuation. I mean, that's kind of a debate that's going on now. You could cap tax-free earnings in retirement. There's many, many, many things that can be done. I mean, what we don't have is the political will to do them. And so this is a political problem. I mean, on the one hand, we can kind of point at Elon Musk or whoever, billionaires, and try and blame them. And that, you know, that kind of might be comforting in some way to feel that someone's to blame. Mm. But there are real and direct policy options that can be taken to reverse the trend.
I guess depending on who you are, you don't have to be a billionaire to be very comfortable, very well off. Are there things that we could be doing at an individual level to share the love a little bit?
At an individual level, I think the main thing that we can do is to exercise our discretion as citizens to make clear what it is that we want and to create the political pressure for things to be done. I mean, I don't think, you know, there's necessarily things that individuals can do. I mean, it's a systemic problem and the system needs to change. And that's only going to change you know, in a democratic system, if enough people wanted to change. And that's, we haven't kind of got to that stage. I think there's probably not enough public awareness of the real problems that we have around inequality. So to continue to debate those in public forums, that's why I'm really happy to be on your program to be talking about this, is really what's important, and to engage it through the democratic process rather than, you know, have these decisions controlled by a small number of wealthy people looking after their own financial interests.
Well, Carl, I'm very happy to have had you on here talking about it too. Thanks so much for joining me.
Absolutely my pleasure, Tees, and thanks.
Carl Rhodes is Professor of Business and Society at the University of Technology, Sydney, and he's the author of a book called Stinking Rich, The Four Myths of the Good Billionaire. Thank you for your texts. Greg says, if I had a lazy $1 trillion, I'd buy up huge areas of old growth forests and employ people to maintain it and look after visitors. Also, what about at a certain point, a number of shares in a company go to the government? Well, coming up next here on Life Matters, do you ever wish we could just dispense with small talk? I'm going to talk about what happens when you stop bothering with polite conversation.
During an emergency,
almost 24 hours with no power, no hot water, no Wi-Fi, no nothing.
For the information you need when you need it.
Power's not on, the line's still down, the tree's still on it.
No internet reception at all, and no TV reception even with our generator.
Find your local ABC radio station.
Thank goodness for you guys, we've got a battery radio and keep up to date.
ABC Radio is your emergency broadcaster.
When you're stuck in a lift or you're waiting for a meeting to start, what's your go-to small talk opener? Something really shallow and innocuous to break the ice. Do you talk about the weather? Do you talk about the traffic? Do you ask everyone's coffee shop preferences? Mine is super lame. I just like, oh, how's your day been so far? But it gets you thinking about why we even make small talk and what happens if you just stop. One writer has done that. Claire Easton recently wrote an article where she says she was relieved to dispense with the pleasantries during COVID and just never went back. So then when someone tried to engage in polite surface-level chat with her, she made a concerted effort to ask something deeper or more personal in response. Someone I will never tire of talking to, small or big, is Christine Bagley-Jones. She's our resident psychologist. She joins me fortnightly for Head and Heart. Christine, how's your day been so far?
I know what you're doing here, Tegan. It's been okay.
Do you have a small talk opener, or are you just straight to the big talk?
Look, it's quite an occupational hazard of mine that I struggle with small talk, because habitually in my day job, we dispense with that almost within the first couple of minutes. And so, yeah, the trap I'm in is I've got to probably lean back into it sometimes. And I don't love small talk. So, yeah, I find I go deep very quickly, which is different from a lot of the other people I communicate with outside of work.
I want to know now what's your opening question in a therapy session usually?
Well, it varies, because, you know, you have a very personal relationship. So you usually know what that client has roughly been doing. So I can normally pick up a thread from last session. But if nothing comes to mind, I might just say, tell me what's been happening.
Mm. Which could be as big or as shallow as you want it to be, an icebreaker. So I mentioned this article by Claire Easton. What was it about Claire's story that stood out for you?
I loved the idea of it. I loved the fact that she was so self-aware that she discovered that the small talk was actually depleting her energy, and she was self-described as an introvert. So she didn't have a lot of fuel in the tank when she went out, and then she was using it all up in kind of not very deep chatter, which then would mean she'd go home and think, well, what was that all about? What a waste. And she consciously decided to change it up.
The thing that got me, because I was like, oh, well, then what are you talking about? And she talks about meeting someone and asking them straight up what their star sign was, which is almost like a cliched pickup line, really. But then it was the thing that then sparked a deeper conversation. So it doesn't have to be like, tell me your deepest fears, or what's your relationship like with your father, to sort of get out of the small talk vibe.
Oh, and you've got to go carefully too. And the star sign one is a bit controversial, because you have those that believe and those that don't. But even that would spark an interesting conversation potentially. I also liked she was talking about being in an art gallery, and instead of just commenting on the art, she asked the person next to her, what was your art teacher at school like? And I thought, that's a bit left off centre. It would catch people off guard. I don't know if I would have the appetite to do that, but I loved the idea of looking at the theme and then just going a bit left off centre.
What are we trying to do when we're engaging in small talk?
Small talk in and of itself isn't a beast. It's actually helpful and really essential because it's kind of like testing the waters when you're with someone, whether it's someone that you know well or someone that you're just getting to know. It's gauging where they're at, because even someone that you might know well might not be in the mood to go deeply. So it's kind of like that foray, but the problem is we could be a bit lazy or just not be able, for whatever reason, go deeper. And then it just stops at those, you know, entry level conversations, which were really just designed to sort of safen the situation so that you're setting the tone to go to the really nourishing conversations.
I'm wondering about whether this is a human thing or a cultural thing. I don't know if you know, Christine, like, do other cultures have a similar level of small talk? Is it kind of a universal human experience to chat and fill space? Or is this something that we've sort of learned through a cultural lens?
Tegan, I do think it varies from culture to culture. I think some cultures very much are comfortable with silences, so they don't have to fill it all with bump. They can actually just sit comfortably. And other cultures also have other rules. Like, we're quite a low context culture in that we rely on words more than body language or rituals or norms. So some cultures are very value orientated or family orientated. So it's very reasonable early on in the conversation to go straight to how's your mother's health, or going into deeper conversations quicker because it's already established as a norm, which we don't tend to have.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking to our resident psychologist, Christine Bagley-Jones. She joins me fortnightly for a chat that we call Head and Heart. And today we're talking about small talk. Drew in Grafton says, when I'm in a lift, I thank everyone for attending the meeting and ask who's going to take minutes. It usually gets a laugh and starts an interaction between occupants. Another text says, most neurodivergent people can't do small talk. I know that for me, I've trained myself to sort of do it, but I'm constantly worrying that I'm doing it right. Christine, talk to me about neurodivergence and that sort of surface level obligatory conversation.
I think that's why I almost have a preference to communicating with neurodivergent people because they can't see the relevance necessarily. And also there's an awkwardness also to small talk because it feels like it's a game of tennis. It's back and forth, but no one's really thinking that much. Whereas people that are more neurodivergent will be more interested in asking questions that they actually have curiosity about. And I often find that there's a lot of genuine interest in the engagement. So it's nice for us, all of us, to just realize that everyone has different levels of desire around small talk. And perhaps if we all could just get a little bit better at realizing it's just stage one, and the whole goal of it is to ease the situation so that you can go that bit deeper, because that's where all of the really good stuff for our health is.
I'm getting so many fantastic suggestions on the text line. I want you to give me like an out of 10 how you think that they rate in terms of small / big talk, Christine. Sean says, I like to try what's on your mind right now, or is there anything challenging right now you're comfortable talking about?
Well, I love that. That is super brave. You'd probably need to choose your audience a little bit there. If you're in the lift with that one, that could you don't have the time before you're stepping out. But I love that because that's the sort of thing that we want. We want to be really genuinely curious about people, but not make them uncomfortable either.
Another one, Amy in Castlemaine says, I like that some other cultures ask, what do you dedicate yourself to rather than what do you do for work? Gives people room to speak about a hobby, an interest, their family or pets, something they're currently passionate about.
That's a 10 out of 10.
What are your hobbies, Christine?
My hobbies? Well, I love yoga and pickleball and reading and hanging out with my family when they're not driving me nuts. And I have lots of hobbies and I love hearing about other people's hobbies because I do see them as, like, hobbies are such an important part of our life. And it's true what that caller was suggesting is we go straight to what do you do for work instead of, I guess, the things that people often would prefer to talk about, which is things that are a bit more connected to who they are.
You ask someone what they do for work and they sigh. You ask someone what they do for a hobby and you see their eyes light up.
They light up, yeah.
And Gilda says, tell me something you've done for yourself lately is her opener.
That is, I'm wondering if she's in the healthcare profession because that's such a beautiful statement because there's a bit of love infused with that too. And it's that sort of reminder in life, like that's almost like a bumper sticker. It's like, I want to know more about you, but I want to know what you're doing for you. That it ticks so many boxes. I'd love to have a chat with her.
Some really great chatters on the text line. Christine, what steps can we take if we do want to go that layer deeper, we do want to discover that more nourishing conversations, as you said before, where do you start?
So be kind to yourself if you're not used to it, because it is a skill and it's not for the faint-hearted, because you have to be kind of brave, don't you? Small talk's safe. We already know that it can't really go too badly. Once you start going a bit deeper, you could press buttons. So I think the very first step is self-awareness. Just be ready for, this could be a bit tricky and I'm having to engage with some courage, which is really good for my health. And now I'm also going to listen to that person differently. It's not about the talk, it's about the listen and picking up on any cue that could then allow for that deeper conversation a little bit more on their terms rather than your terms. And then just be willing to share, because once you share a little bit, hopefully it becomes reciprocal and that's where you'll get that sort of momentum of a deeper conversation.
It still feels kind of like rolling out lines like this, like we're doing with the texts and the sorts of examples we're giving still feels quite scripted. There's a lovely text here saying, it doesn't matter what you say, the important part is being genuine and interacting with authenticity. I think this is what people call deep.
I agree. And in fact, you know, I know we overuse the word authenticity and I wish we could have other words so it would be fresh again in people's minds, because if you take that to almost any setting, it's going to bode well because it's going to sit well with you and the other person's going to be more interested because they don't feel like there's that barrier of superficiality. So being genuine is really key. And yeah, it's not often what you're asking or what you're saying, it's how you're doing it. And if it's with genuine interest and hopefully some empathy, like I'm curious about what's going on for you. I may not even know you that well, but just from a humanistic level, I do care.
Well, I need to close on my version of the star sign question, which is what biscuit are you in those family packs of the various assorted creams? What biscuit are you, Christine?
Tegan, I've tapped them all and it really is a mood thing, because once you've overdone the Kingston, you've got to move on to those, you know, those ones that are like a shortbread with the cream in the middle?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I like them.
They're called shortbread cream, I think.
Right, okay.
Incredible. Perfect answer. 10 out of 10. I'm a Monte Carlo, in case you couldn't tell. Well, Christine Begley-Jones, thank you so much for joining me as always.
Most welcome, Tegan.
Psychologist Christine Begley-Jones is founder of Plenish Mind Health. She joins me fortnightly for our chats that I call head and heart. More text on small talk. When I first moved to Australia, I started the morning by reading the sports headlines in the newspaper, then just repeating the one in the office tea room. It always sparked conversation. Greg says, my small talk starts with, so how's the quantum world treating you? To which I would say, Greg, I'm feeling quite entangled right now. We were talking before about Elon Musk poised to become the world's first trillionaire, and I asked what you would do with $1 trillion. Well, Maz in Melbourne says, the important question isn't what would we do with $1 trillion, it's how much better would a world look if it wasn't possible for trillionaires to exist. Thousands of workers contribute to Musk's wealth, and his wealth should belong to them. We also spoke about smoking and the role of illicit tobacco in being a barrier to getting Australians off cigarettes. David says prohibition has been proven to fail and be extremely socially costly, so focus has to be on controlling illegal distribution. How about introduce penalties like 90% assets seizure plus prison time as a penalty for illegal distributors? Money is their motivation, so take it away. And we talked about small talk and why it might be worth getting past the small talk and starting to have some conversations with some deeper questions. One text says, in Sweden, small talk is called death talk. In other words, a waste of time. Well, that is almost it for Life Matters today, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about shopping ethically as we approach Christmas, that time of mass consumption, plus how our relationship with our coastline is shifting thanks to climate change, and giving teens places to test their limits, even if it kind of terrifies us. Don't forget, you can get in touch with me anytime. My email is lifematters@abc.net.au, and I'll catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.